Ecclesiastes 4. The preacher writes, "Again, I saw all the oppressions that are done under the sun, and behold, the tears of the oppressed, and they had no one to comfort them. On the side of their oppressors there was power, and there was no one to comfort them. And I thought the dead who are already dead more fortunate than the living who are still alive, but better than both is he who has not yet been and has not seen the evil deeds that are done under the sun. Then I saw that all toil and all skill in work come from a man's envy of his neighbor. This also is vanity and a striving after wind. The fool folds his hands and eats his own flesh. Better is a handful of quietness than two hands full of toil and a striving after wind. Again, I saw vanity under the sun. One person who has no other, either son or brother, yet there is no end to all his toil, and his eyes are never satisfied with riches, so that he never asks, 'For whom am I toiling and depriving myself of pleasure?' This also is vanity and an unhappy business. Two are better than one, because they have a good reward for their toil. For if they fall, one will lift up his fellow. But woe to him who is alone when he falls, and has not another to lift him up. Again, if two lie together, they keep warm. But how can one keep warm alone? And though a man might prevail against one who is alone, two will withstand him. A threefold cord is not quickly broken. Better was a poor and wise youth than an old and foolish king who no longer knew how to take advice. For he went from prison to the throne, though in his own kingdom he had been born poor. I saw all the living who move about under the sun, along with that youth who was to stand in the king's place. There was no end of all the people, all of whom he led. Yet those who come later will not rejoice in him. Surely this also is vanity and a striving after wind." Great. Do keep that open, and also these sheets, as ever. There's some notes on the inside, which are going to be a help to you and to me as we look at it together. Now, community has become something of a buzzword, I think, in our society. It's one of those warm glow sorts of words, like motherhood or apple pie. We all love community. And whilst we love the idea of community, and we all want a strong and supportive community, no one would dispute that, I think often we find the practice of committing to real people, especially ones we haven't chosen, or especially ones who aren't much like us, much, much harder. Take, for example, our extended families, if we've got them. On paper, at least, what could be simpler than loving those people we have so much in common with and so much shared experience? But I guess, and I won't do a poll of hands, but how often in extended families is there some significant broken relationship or some tension which is stifling community? And the point is that it's much easier to say that we believe in love and acceptance in theory. We all perhaps, you know, on social media, we click like on the "no them, only us" meme. But we find it much harder to love and to accept real people. I don't think I'm just speaking for myself. And so far in this book of Ecclesiastes, little recap, the repeated advice in chapter 2 and in chapter 3 has been that whilst we do live in a cursed world, and you'll remember this was our illustration for the whole series, we live in a world which is marked by vapor. That's the word which is often translated vanity in our Bibles. It means literally vapor. Whilst we live in that kind of world which is fleeting, which is hard to grasp, living wisely means learning to receive our Creator's gifts in thankfulness, learning that life is about gifts more than gain. And today we're coming to consider this special gift of God of community. It's a very precious gift. It's one that should be valued by us very highly. And yet we're also going to see, as we look at these verses together, that community is something which is very difficult to achieve in practice. And those are the two strands, I think, which weave the whole chapter together, as we're going to see. And the first thing I think the writer wants to show us, and I put there on the sheets, is that community can protect the oppressed. And the way the writer, who I think is Solomon, proves his point is by showing how terrible the world is when community has stopped functioning properly. Look again at verse 1 in the Bibles. Again, I saw all the oppressions that are done under the sun, and behold the tears of the oppressed, and they had no one to comfort them. On the side of their oppressors there was power, and there was no one to comfort them. And I thought the dead that are already dead more fortunate than the living who are still alive. But better than both is he who has not yet been and has not seen the evil deeds that are done under the sun. So this is saying that, I guess, what we already know, which is that suffering is terrible, but specifically it's adding that it's worsened when suffering is experienced alone. If you know the New Testament, the gospel writers point specifically to this point in Jesus' experience in the Garden of Gethsemane. It's not just that Jesus suffers terrible oppression, which he does. It's that at his point of need, his friends, and you'll remember, they first of all, they fall asleep on him, then they deny him, then they run off and abandon him. And like Jeremiah in Jeremiah 20, or like Job in Job 3, Solomon says that in such instances, the suffering can be so desperate that it feels like it would have been better never to have lived. And the comfort that is lacking in verse 1, did you notice they had no one to comfort them? There was no one to comfort them. In the Bible, that word for comfort includes not just emotional, but practical comfort. One of the real benefits of community when it's working properly is that it can protect the oppressed, practically speaking, and it can start to make life bearable again. So community is a very precious gift of God. But next we come to one of the chief reasons why true community is so hard to find. So yes, community can protect the oppressed, yet, on the sheets, rivalry undermines it. It seems always to do that. Verse 4, then I saw all toil and all skill in work come from a man's envy of his neighbor. Pretty categorical. I don't know if you've been, I had the opportunity a while back to go to a school reunion. Maybe you've done something similar 10 years, 20 years on. And those are generally enjoyable, partly, I think, because we're nosy. We want to know what's happened to so-and-so. We like catching up with old friends and so on. But one of the things which gets exposed very often, and this was true in my experience, is how quick we are to see life as a competition. And someone says, oh, who'd have thought it? You know, she was doing so well at school, wasn't she? And now she's really slipped behind. And all the time, all the people you're meeting, they're busy presenting their achievements very subtly and how important they are. Oh, yes, being head of department now, it's very difficult, really. So much travel. You know, I barely get to see the slopes at all these days. You know, and they're all just gently dropping in what their life's like. And if we doubt verse 4, that so much of our energy and our drive in life comes actually from this kind of rivalry and envy, trying to prove how important we are compared to other people. Just think in your own experience now, what happens when someone that we deem unworthy gets the break or gets the promotion or gets the opportunity that we think we should have got? Have you had that experience? And it just means that we're seething. And we justify it in our own minds and we say, well, our concern really here is for justice. That's why I'm so upset. But it's funny how our concern for justice suddenly slips away when we get the lucky break, perhaps because we've got some helpful connections. And we say, well, that's just the way life is sometimes. You've got to just live with it. And incidentally, I think this may be part of the connection between verses 1 to 3 and verse 4. Did you notice verse 1 is not talking about suffering in general? Verse 1 is talking about people suffering specifically because of oppression. And whilst there is such a thing as that kind of vindictive, cruel-minded oppression, mainly oppression comes from people just seeking after their own gain without concern for others. And of course, when people are climbing up a ladder, they often don't notice even the people they're stepping on beneath them. Why would they? When they're being driven by envy and their eyes are transfixed on those who are two rungs above them, those people who have got what they want, why would they notice anybody else? And verse 4 is so ordinary, isn't it? Then I saw that all toil and all skill in work come from a man's envy of his neighbor. And we say, yeah, of course, this is just ordinary life. And yet it's so destructive. And especially it's so corrosive to community, true community. And you may have observed this yourself. You may be aware of this in a family context. You may be aware of it in a church context. Where there is envy, where there is rivalry, it kills community. And that is why such work is, at the end of verse 4, vapor, vanity, and a striving after wind. Of course it is. If community is so precious, this gift of God, then any work that is effectively undermining community can only end up ultimately impoverishing, whatever the pay packet might be. And so we're left thinking, well, what's the answer? You know, if so much work, day-to-day work, is driven by envy, what should we do? Perhaps we should opt out of work altogether. Well, no, that's damaging in a different way. Let's keep going. Verse 5. The fool folds his hands, laziness, and eats his own flesh. So it's a very vivid proverb. There's a deeper damage simply than someone eating away at their savings. The lazy person eats away at who he or she is, at their self-respect, at their self-control, at their dignity. No, the answer is not opting out. The answer is learning to work in a new way, learning to work with contentment. Look at verse 6. Better is a handful of quietness than two hands full of toil and a striving after wind. So this is saying it's better not to take the promotion. It's better not to work the long hours if deep down I'm doing it to prove just how important I am. Because as soon as I do that, then my work immediately becomes a vapor, a striving after wind. And God will make sure it will come to nothing, ultimately. No, it's better to have only one hand full of wages or profits, but for our work to be coming out of a contentment. And then at last I can start doing my work to serve others, rather than deep down motivated by envy and rivalry. So I hope we're seeing why this thing called community, which is so precious, is actually so elusive, so hard to come by. And I hope we're seeing that the obstacle to community is right here. It's in our own hearts. It's in me. So next we're shown on your sheets that how community both dignifies our work and enhances our lives. So first, community dignifies our work. Verse 7. Again, I saw vanity under the sun. One person who has no other, either son or brother, yet there is no end to all his toil, and his eyes are never satisfied with riches, so that he never asks, for whom am I toiling and depriving myself of pleasure? This also is vanity and an unhappy business. So having seen the losers in this human struggle, we saw them in verses 1 to 3, didn't we? The oppressed. Now we're introduced to the apparent winner, financially at least. Here he is. And yet this fat cat, this compulsive moneymaker, is not really much to aspire to, because all that's left is this feeding of a craving which will never be satisfied. And this guy in particular gets a double helping of that vapor verdict. He gets it in verse 7 and then again at the end of verse 8. Vanity, vanity. And what's emphasized here is about the vanity is that there's no one he's serving. Did you notice that in verse 8? He never asks, for whom am I toiling? You see, without community, without others to serve, however hard we work, it will lack its proper dignity. It will lack its fundamental purpose in terms of serving and loving others. In Ephesians 4, we did Ephesians last year in our Bible studies. In Ephesians 4:28, the thief is told, I'll quote, "Let the thief no longer steal, but rather let him labor, doing honest work with his own hands." Why? "So that he may have something to share with anyone in need." It's a lovely verse. It's describing here, there that Christians are saved into a community. And one of the great privileges is that their work now carries a new dignity. So they're going to work each day so that they can now share with those in need. It's a beautiful picture. And the next verse underlines, or next verses underline how it is that community also enhances our lives. Look at verse 9. "Two are better than one, because they have a good reward for their toil." Verse 10, "For if they fall, one will lift up his fellow. But woe to him who's alone when he falls and has not another to lift him up. Again, if two lie together, they keep warm. But how can one keep warm alone? And though a man might prevail against one who is alone, two will withstand him. A threefold cord is not quickly broken." Now, we notice immediately these verses are very realistic about life in a cursed world. One of the big themes we've been looking at. We will be knocked down, or at the very least, there will be obstacles to try and trip us up. There will be difficult journeys necessitating sleeping outside in the cold sometimes. There will be attacks from enemies. And in all of these situations, companionship is what enhances our work and our lives. Verse 9 says, "Two will have a good reward for their toil." It's interesting because in a book which has told us repeatedly not to expect ultimate gain from our work, there is here at least relative gain, isn't there? There is a good reward for their toil from cooperative work. It's important to see it's not holding up two as the optimum number. It's certainly not glorifying coupledom, because just as two is better than one, the verses say that three is better than two. Verse 12, in what seems to be the high point of the chapter, after this crescendo of verses 9 to 12, verse 12 says, "Two will withstand him, a threefold cord is not quickly broken." Now, some of us will have been at weddings where this verse is read on its own, and it's taken to mean that the couple need God at the center of their marriage, weaving them together like a threefold cord. And undoubtedly that is true, but it's not the truth of what this verse here is saying in Ecclesiastes 4. Here it's saying that whilst two are helpful, three is even better. Three is the beginnings, not of a crowd, but of a community. In fact, if it says anything to married couples, it says, you need friends. If you know the film About a Boy with Hugh Grant, apparently, again, it's been made into a book or something. Anyway, I only know the film. The film closes with the boy giving a concluding voiceover, kind of summarizing the message of the film, explaining that couples do not work on their own and that everyone needs an extended support system to get by. And I'm pretty sure that Solomon would heartily agree with that message. We need community. So community is very precious. And yet the passage closes with another potential obstacle to community, namely, on the sheets, that advancement can often undermine it. And now the chapter ends with this warning that being a leader of a great multitude is no substitute for being in a real community of peers, friends. Look at verse 13. "Better was a poor and wise youth than an old and foolish king who no longer knew how to take advice." For he, now I know there's two ways of reading this, but I take the he here to be the old king. For he, the old king, went from prison to the throne, though in his own kingdom he had been born poor. So here both the youth and the king, I take it, have come from humble beginnings. But the king no longer knew how to take advice, verse 13. So there was something that's happened to him. There's something about his advancement to kingship which had been bad for him. And it had caused him in some way to lose touch with trusted friends and advisors. And it goes on, verse 15, I saw all the living who move about under the sun, along with that youth who was to stand in the king's passage. There was no end of all the people, all of whom he led. Yet those who came later will not rejoice in him. Surely this also is vanity and a striving after wind. So although the king had masses of followers, keeps getting repeated, all of them, he didn't have, do you remember in verse 13, masses of trusted peers. What he didn't have was friends who could speak hard truths into his life. That's the advice in verse 14 that he needed. And that's why his reign will not be well remembered, verse 16. So these verses are saying that popularity is not the same thing as real community. Facebook friends are not the same thing as friends. A wide network is not the same thing as a real community. And in particular, it's saying that advancement often isolates people from real community. I think the point of the story is that kingship is what the people of that day most aspired to. In reality, it would have been very, very unlikely that many kings would have gone from obscurity into royalty, as both kings did in this story. It's a very unlikely scenario, but it's meant to capture our imaginations. And it's saying, even that thing that you most aspire to, even that thing which you think would fix all of your problems, that thing which would take away all of your troubles in life, that career advancement, that lottery win, whatever it is, that situation of all situations is actually going to isolate you. And given how precious community is, why on earth would we idolize that? It's absolute madness. Some sociologists have actually defined being working class or being middle class according to whether someone lives where they do based on people. So, you know, my nan, my parents, all our friends, we've always lived on this estate. Why would we move? That's working class. Or whether someone lives where they do based on what they do. And I take it that it's just a given, isn't it, for middle class people that they keep moving around as study or as work opportunities arise. And community doesn't really figure in their thinking. After all, you know, if I have a baby, perhaps I'll pay to join an NCT group. If I'm struggling and I need an older, wiser head to chat things through with, I'll just pay for a psychiatrist and so on and so on. And I'm saying this to myself because these are exactly the kinds of values which I've just breathed in and taken for granted. But I think Solomon would question why it is, for me, I put such a low value, therefore, on community. In verses 13 to 16, he's saying, you know that advancement which you think is going to fix everything? Well, if it serves to isolate you from peer community, from the kind of community where people speak hard truths into your life, which is what this king needed, and actually that's what advancement often will do, if it does that, it is not worth it. Community is far too precious, he says. C.S. Lewis, in his book, The Great Divorce, he tries to describe a day trip to hell. And he depicts hell very interestingly as a kind of hyper-individualism, each person choosing to live several streets away from the next person. because people are completely turned in on themselves and all community and all companionship has gone. And it's an interesting picture, and I think it reflects well the Bible's repeated insistence that loving community is at the center of what God is calling us to. It's the center of the humanity that we're called to and the redeemed humanity that we're called to. And yet, it seems like it's a massive blind spot to us, I think especially as 21st century Londoners. We don't even notice this kind of hyper-individualism that we express. Incidentally, that's part of the reason when the church started, Andrew and I were so keen in the first year of our church's life for us to study Ephesians together so that we can get this into our DNA as a church. God's purpose for us is to be a loving community. God's purpose is that we would be the kind of community that the world outside has never seen, that kind of depth of relationship. Now, up until now, in our Ecclesiastes studies, I've been quite sparing, you'll have noticed, with jumping to the New Testament too quickly. I want us to hear Ecclesiastes in its own terms first, before we look somewhere else. But I do want us now to think about how this Old Testament passage might apply to us as New Testament believers. And what we've done so far is we've seen these twin truths, haven't we? We've seen about how precious loving community is. It protects the oppressed. It dignifies our work. It enhances our lives. And yet at the same time, we've seen how difficult true community is to achieve. How quickly it's undermined by our rivalry, verse 4, by our selfish ambition, verse 8, by our fixation with advancement, verse 13. So our question is, what happens to these twin truths when we pass them through the prism of Jesus and the gospel, when we pass them out into the New Testament? And the answer is that whilst there are some changes, and there are certainly new resources for us as God's people, as New Testament rather than Old Testament believers, really this message carries through directly into the New Testament. And I've put on the sheets there, number 3, community is still precious but difficult to achieve for us as New Testament believers. I just want to step back and think about generally how the Old Testament applies to us as New Testament believers. The way some people read from old to new is they instinctively think it's a switch from bad to good. And this is a caricature, but sometimes people say, you know, God gave his law to people through Moses, bad, then Jesus gives us the gospel, good. And I know that's a caricature, but this approach is very often related or applied to the book of Ecclesiastes. And it's assumed that poor Solomon is confused and he's ignorant, especially about all these things that we know more about from the New Testament, more details about the new creation and so on. And so we read it as, poor Solomon, if only he knew as much as we do, he wouldn't be quite so depressed. And of course, now that we have the New Testament, all of these tensions and difficulties that he's bothered by get fixed pretty quickly. But I think that's not the way the Bible presents the transition from the Old to the New Testament. It's not so much bad to good as good to even better. And with Ecclesiastes in particular, the tensions and the difficulties which Solomon is so aware of and that we've been seeing week by week, yes, we do have extra resources as New Testament believers, but in general, these tensions will persist as long as you and I live in a cursed world. And actually, that is why we have been finding, I hope you've been finding, that Ecclesiastes does speak so powerfully into our situations today. So as I was thinking, where are we going to go in the New Testament to apply these truths? And it would be tempting for me to jump to the end of Acts 2. You might know that's a very famous passage painting the picture of how on the day of Pentecost, God, by the Holy Spirit and by the preaching of the gospel, created a new community, the church, a community where the people had everything in common, and cared for the poor amongst them. And we could look at that passage and we could say, look, thanks to the gospel, God has done a miracle within us, which he has. And I could say, look, all those tensions in Ecclesiastes 4 have finally gone away. But of course, if we keep reading in Acts, that community hit all kinds of problems. In chapter 5, the community was threatened by selfishness and greed, if you know the Ananias and Sapphira incident. By chapter 6, there's some racial tension in the church because one group were accusing another group of not distributing the resources fairly and so on. And these situations required real wisdom and strength to overcome. And so when we're considering what happens to the message of Ecclesiastes generally when we get to the New Testament, what I'm discovering is that the book of James is a wonderful place to go. And that's my top tip for you. So James, out of all the New Testament writers, I think seems to have been the one most shaped by the book of Ecclesiastes. Let me give you a flavor. Last week, Ecclesiastes 3, you'll remember, was about humbly accepting that God is the Lord of time and not us. And if you remember very well, you remember our reading was from James 4 about not boasting about our plans because we don't know what tomorrow will bring. Trusting God is the Lord of time. The first two chapters of Ecclesiastes were about how life is a mist, a vapor. And yet that's okay because life is really about gift more than it's about gain. And of course, James is the writer who tells us that, yes, our lives are like mist, chapter 4:14 of James, and that God, by contrast, is the Father of lights with whom there is no variation or shadow due to change, and every good and perfect gift comes from him, just like the writer of Ecclesiastes. Or next week, I'm going to give away, this is a spoiler, so cover your ears if you don't want to hear. But Ecclesiastes 5 is about being quick to hear and slow to speak, which, if you know James, is exactly what James tells us in the first chapter of James. And therefore, it's not a big surprise to us that the precise concerns we're looking at today in Ecclesiastes 4 are also picked up, and this was our reading, in James 3-4. About how disunity is caused by, from the reading, our passions warring within us, selfish ambition and so on. And that becoming peaceable requires wisdom from above. It's not going to be easy. It's not going to be automatic for us, even as New Testament believers. So that was an extended aside to say that Ecclesiastes is not sub-Christian. The message that community is precious but very difficult to achieve is just as true for us as Christian believers. And the message of Ecclesiastes 4 is for us to realize that this battle for real community for each one of us begins right here. Begins in our own hearts and in our own battles with sin. Yes, through Jesus, God has miraculously joined us into one family. I had a conversation only this week. Someone was telling me how they've experienced a love and a depth of relationship in Grace Church, which they said was supernatural. And I guess lots of us here would echo that. We've received that kind of experience here at Grace Church. But the way each of us can pursue being the kind of community which God desires for us is by each of us taking seriously this call to put to death the sins in our own hearts. Perhaps for some of us, it really is envy. Perhaps someone else is receiving a blessing from God, which I think I should be getting. Maybe for us, the problem is selfish ambition. Maybe it's a fixation with advancement. Perhaps I don't even notice the needs of others in the fellowship because my life is all about me getting ahead. Well, if that is us, we need to be putting those sins to death. And as I trust that God is wise and generous and that he is the Lord of time and that he will ultimately reward his servants, these things we've been learning in Ecclesiastes, I will be able to put to death envy and greed and selfish ambition. And as a fellowship, as we grow, as we mature in these things together, we will experience even more what it is to be the kind of community that God calls us to be, the kind of community which is a light, which is a beacon shining out to those outside.